The material provided today is for informational purposes only. It should not be considered legal or financial advice. Consult with a financial professional for your own needs. John E. Sestina & Company disclaims any and all liability for the interpretation and use of the content provided today.
I need help getting out of my student loan debt.
I'm so worried. How am I going to afford taking care of my parents?
When's a good time to get into the market?
I'm really not sure when I should start taking my Social Security.
I wonder if I have enough insurance.
I wonder when I can retire.
It's time to talk about your money, managing to be wealthy. Our team of fee-only financial planners is ready to help you create better financial habits, envision your long-term goals, and understand money management better than ever. Our resident hosts of John E. Sestina & Company are on deck to show you the way.
Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Tracy Bennett. Today, we're digging into the money lessons from some of history's biggest names. What did they get right? Where do they stumble? And what can we learn from it today? Joining me in studio are what I consider to be our resident MTBW history buffs and certified financial planners, Tony Payne and Spencer Hager. So let's get into it. I know you guys are excited about this. You love history. This is definitely your forte. I hear you guys talk a lot about it in the office. I think this will be a lot of fun.
Yeah, this is exciting. We say history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And this is going to be one of those shows where we talk about some of the lessons of finance and history and some of those times where it rhymes.
So I want to start with building wealth with purpose. And I'm kind of just going to spitball these and let you roll with it, given your, I'm sure you've done some research on your own, but it'll be fun to kind of compare then with now. What would Mansa Musa think of a modern investor hoarding cash instead of building wealth like a gold-rich empire?
You'd probably be wondering, what the heck is this cash stuff? You know, why the hell are you holding this paper instead of actual gold or salt? Actual things.
It was still the barter system back then.
Right.
Yeah, no, probably what Tony said. I agree.
Right. You know, actual things, and probably rightfully so, right? That's all he knew and was the world's richest person, maybe arguably throughout all of history. Mm-hmm. So you wonder, was he right or not? Who knows? But the idea of physical things, that was really throughout history the only way to hold wealth. It wasn't until kind of recently that we had fiat currency, you know, something that you didn't actually do something with to hold value.
We think we're so superior. In today's world, you know, with our technology and the way that we do things, and you kind of look back on the way people handled things like this, and they were a lot smarter, I think, than we give them credit for. First of all, I'm not a history buff. Who is Mansa Musa?
I was not familiar with him either until getting ready for this. I think he was effectively just a leading ruler of the Mali Empire or something like that. So back in the 1300s, something like
Emperor
that.
Emperor of Mali?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so a lot of gold and trade.
To Tony's point, we didn't go off the gold standard in America until Nixon, right? So even though it was cash, it was at least backed by something, whereas now it's a little bit more backed on faith and strength of the U.S. government kind of deal. So
he wasn't trading shells or anything. It wasn't that far
back. No. I mean, it was probably a healthy mixture of both, but yeah.
No, for lots of history, I mean, known as probably the richest person in the history of the world. I mean, having gold. I mean, there was a time where, not a time, but there's a quote basically where Mansa Musa would say, gold grows in our empire like plants. So, I mean, that was, you know, a quote known then. So the idea of how much did they have, that's, you know, if gold grew like a plant, I mean, holy crap, that's a lot of gold.
You think about the sunken ships, like the Atosha, you know, all the gold sitting at the bottom of the ocean.
That's a small little handful compared to that, right?
Where did they get it all, you know? That's fascinating.
Yep.
All right, next one is banking on stability. Let's talk about Jacob Fugger and the art of diversification in uncertain markets. So if Jacob had a 401k, do you think he would still be investing in mining or maybe crypto? And let's, I guess, talk about who he was first. It's probably a good first start.
Well, again, when your nickname is Jacob the Rich, that tells you something right away. And this person was in Italy, you know, Middle Ages, the Renaissance, really. And the parts I really attached to were used a lot of money on political contributions, really plugged in. You seem to, you know, whether it was crypto or, you know, other monies, seem to put their money in a lot of wise places with a lot of rich families, a lot of politically connected people, even seem to be connected to the Vatican even. Lots of money in the right places, it seemed like. So that's, and textiles as well, so industry. That seemed to be the really the right places at the right time. So, again, when you go through and say what were the similarities then to now, again, political connections, the idea of putting the money out there and investing and being with those in industry, not much has changed. I mean, Jacob the Rich could be someone nowadays, same idea of being connected and putting your money out there. We saw a lot of people on TV today. We're seeing conferences today of people well-connected with people in politics. Spencer, you're laughing at me here.
Yeah, no, it's good timing, yeah. We're doing this at the, we're recording this the day of the summit in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. So, yeah, definitely some big industry over there that are seeing what's going down in
Jacob the Rich would be there.
He would be there. We'd be proud of him.
I was just curious. Do we know when the term diversification came into play in finance? Was, you know, they obviously wouldn't have called it that then.
I know Ben Franklin was preaching it, so yeah. At least then, at least the 1700s.
Yep.
I mean, you think Adam Smith way back when, I mean, the Wealth of Nations, the concept of having a diverse basket, at least as a nation, of where was your income coming from. I mean, that was prevalent back then.
Yep.
So, again, I think that was important. So it's been around for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Pretty cool. Adapting for growth. So let's talk about Catherine the Great. Known for economic modernization and modern financial mindset. So would she be the type to invest in AI startups today, do you think?
Probably, yeah.
Something like that?
I think so.
FinTech empire, maybe?
Maybe, yeah.
She really tried to take the Russian Empire and change it and make that basically take Western values, a lot of Western thinking, and modernize Russia and basically say, hey, let's go and apply a lot more science and a lot more business values and grow the Russian Empire, and did. And that was a lot of, you know, basically business values. So the idea of applying a lot more technology there and growing what she had probably would.
What are you grinning at?
I'm just cracking up. I'm thinking back to one of the shows we did. I wasn't even on the show, but it was back when El Salvador co-signed Bitcoin. That was like their big innovation play, and Tony was on that show, and he pretty much just destroyed it, saying, like, the wizards of international finance talking about El Salvador and how terrible of an idea it is. So, yeah, it is funny. I like it, innovation for innovation's sake, but yeah, I think she'd be at least on fintech, AI, and some of those for sure.
I didn't know she was behind the modernization of farming and manufacturing and education as well, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I did see that too.
And then that was the technology and kind of the idea of modernization back then, right? So that's the idea of, would that be the AI of today? Sure.
All right, principled prosperity. So Abe Lincoln, let's talk about him. You know, he was known for his integrity, being a strong leader, you know, moral values, all that good stuff.
Suspended habeas corpus. No, I'm joking.
So imagine you're trying to choose a financial advisor in a world of fine print and social media and hidden fees. You channel your inner Lincoln. You grab your sort of metaphorical stovepipe hat and you say, let's read the whole document twice.
Yep.
I mean, talk about how he would approach today.
Yeah. I mean, come on, Sven. You can't make light. I'm not going to make light of it. I mean, throughout history, and it's not just our society, it's throughout history, slavery was a big part of economics, and it's morally reprehensible. There's nothing worse than taking someone's labor, taking their life, taking it for free and using it for yourself. Just terrible. And the idea of ending that practice here, I mean, that's valuable. And to fight a war over it and take the country through it, I mean, that was a hell of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go back through history and think about that and changing the direction of the country, I mean, that's huge.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you think about that as an economic change and the values and the moral change there and the moral compass there, that's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And then let alone the values there and all the failed businesses. I mean, there's a whole nother side to that, just Abe Lincoln the person, where there's all the stories of how many businesses did he have that failed? I mean, he was a failed businessman 100 times over, and it's that one that works that, hey, there's a success there. Mm-hmm. But no one talks about the hundreds that fail. Mm-hmm. So that's another lesson. If you get outside the great moral person and you just look at the business person, well, you got to keep at it. So if there is a lesson there on the other side to that, that's the one I would take away too.
The integrity.
Yeah, the integrity, yeah. But also the stick-to-itness. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're going to have failures, and if you're going to stick to it, well, then hopefully one day you're going to have that success, and you're not going to have that success if you give up.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about philanthropic blueprint for modern legacy planning, Andrew Carnegie comes to mind, so giving while you're growing. And we talk a lot about that when we talk about estate planning. Charitable giving through estate planning, just as one example. So what kind of tool do you think he would go for once he skipped his private jet?
I actually love Carnegie. Rockefeller was pretty high up there too with both of them by the end. It's actually crazy how much they gave to charity. And Carnegie's the one who has all the great quotes where he says something mm-hmm. to the effect of, if you die a wealthy man, you know, you die a disgraced man, pretty much saying that, you know, anything that you don't need for yourself, your family, if you just hoard it all going into the grave, it's... you know, money that should have been given to society and to benefit others. So not saying everyone needs to take on that mantra, but I find it definitely admirable. So, yeah, I'm sure he had massive foundations. He had endowments that he was giving out when he was doing it. Maybe tough for some of us to set up the 8-figure, you know, foundations that mm-hmm. we're going to use to give out to charities. But, you know, people can do it plenty of ways, you know, with other tools that we've talked about in other podcasts, gifting from your existing investment account. So,
Giving while living.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Or bake it into your estate plan at the end, right? Gift through your various trusts and things like that. So a lot of ways you can do it. And I think those are definitely two cases of people you can admire.
Well, and I think also, Spencer, to your point, there are thousands of public libraries mm-hmm. funded by his donations.
100%.
I mean, that's something, too, when you think about the literacy rate of this country and where we're at today. I mean, that's part of it. Yeah. I mean, what an astounding thing to leave a legacy of that.
Absolutely.
So, these are neat things, too, that come about through industry and when you think about things that could repeat and values there. Another neat thing.
I don't want to say anything too inflammatory, too, but it is a little bit crazy when you look at if you inflation adjust what they gave to charity in modern day dollars. Those, you know, Carnegie, Rockefeller, those people are lambasted in some circles is, you know, for all the wrongdoing. And again, with all this we're talking about, it's kind of crazy to see how much industry and everything's changed. Like when you were saying, would they invest in AI these days? And this is my lack of imagination. I don't even know what you can compare to mm-hmm. some of those leaps that they had with innovation back then in today. But what they gave to charity.
Compared refrigeration, maybe.
All right. Yeah, you got me going here.
Compared to current day, what some of these, you know, the massive wealthy people, you know, in industry, what they currently give does not compare to what those people gave.
I'm on a mission, Spencer.
Please,
a great
yeah.
Ohioan. I'm trying to save, repair an image here. All right. Mr. Rockefeller's image. Okay. This guy has been disparaged throughout history, and he's a great guy. You look at him and you say, why has Rockefeller been disparaged throughout history? You know, William Rockefeller. Why? Why, Spencer? Why? Why has he been called a robber baron? Why has this guy been so disparaged?
I could give my answer. I'm just not okay. sure
you're going out here. I'm going there because Ida Tarbell, a writer, a journalist who wrote some articles way back when her dad ran an oil company.
That was your answer, wasn't it?
You don't know.
No, hold on. I'm going there. I'll try to summarize it real quick. I know where we're going here. You're in the car now. But her dad's oil company basically failed. He didn't want to sell to Rockefeller. So he came in, ran them out of business. So she took her grudge, started writing some nasty articles about him. And then his brother, his alcoholic brother, Mr. Rockefeller didn't drink, but his brother did. His brother Bill,
allegedly,
Rockefeller.
Allegedly.
No, he can't sue us now. So Bill Rockefeller here, he basically, his brother, you know, Standard Oil, wonderful stock, a great stock at the time, no longer a stock, so I don't have to worry about it either. So this stock he had given to him, he kept selling it. He kept borrowing against it. This brother, he was a gambler. He was a drunk. He kept losing his money. Well, He kept asking Mr. Rockefeller for more money, and eventually his brother cut him off. Well, what's this brother with a grudge do? He keeps selling his story to this journalist, keeps giving her family dirt, keeps telling her family secrets, keeps making up lies about his brother, but lies that the family member would know that are real enough that this journalist can tell real dirt. So throughout history, this dirt has been prevalent and keeps going from his own brother, because his brother, who's super rich, wouldn't keep giving him more money. So I'd just like to keep repairing an image here, Spencer, of a great Ohioan, a very philanthropic man, somebody who started a lot of historically black universities, a very, you know, good guy here. So I'm just trying to repair an image, Spencer.
Yeah, sources will be cited at the
end. All right. All right. There's a wonderful book. It's about 6 inches thick. It's, you know, Rockefeller's biography.
I like Rockefeller. I like
Carnegie. All right. Thank you. Sorry, Tracy. I had to go off on a little tangent there.
That's pretty much what I said. I just, and then that was a different rabbit hole. So,
all right.
So
thank you.
You think about the technology that existed back then as compared to today. You know, back then it was railroading, you know, being able to transfer goods across the country, and trading empires, right? So global strategies. Queen Elizabeth I was known for her intrigue and diversification and international investment. So how would you think she would handle her investments today? I mean, that would be really interesting to know. Would she diversify into emerging markets? Would she buy stock on her own shipping company? You know, and that was fascinating to me is, and no offense to anybody, I mean, I'm a female, but that was pretty amazing back then for a woman to be that open, you know, to be, you know, put her intelligence, deck like that.
Yeah. It was pretty, I mean, she, the reign of power, the influence, let alone the wealth that she was in charge of. And then, I mean, yeah, I agree with you, Tracy. There was a lot of power there and the wealth that was able to be accumulated and grown. Yeah. And the idea of what would she be into today, or the kind of investments, whether that was shipping, transport, I mean, this kind of things that are specific, that makes sense. Usually, get into what you know, and sometimes that is a good investment strategy. Not always. Usually diversification's best, but for those who want to get their hands dirty, it makes sense to get into what you know, and that way you have some control over it. So that might have been something that, hey, if I'm in the family business or I have some control or I've inherited something and I have this interest already, you know what? Why not? I don't know your thoughts on it, Spencer.
No, I agree with that. I've actually been doing a lot of research on like U.S. U.S. history and things like that recently. And so I just think it's interesting from the standpoint you compare today to 200 years ago, like the guardrails we have in place nowadays when you talk about investing is just completely different. Like the idea that in the 1800s in the U.S. you had pretty much economic downturns every couple of years, and it would just be due to like no regulation, loose policy. You know, one president would say something or Congress would go crazy, and then all of a sudden you would just have – you know, hundreds of banks shutter their doors kind of deal. So a little bit different these days, I guess, to tie back to, you know, which queen are we talking about now at this point? I'm sorry.
Queen Elizabeth I.
I almost went back to Catherine. You know, I would just think, again, when you talk about investing in emerging markets, to me it always comes back to, like, risk management. Is North Korea an emerging market? Probably not. So just know what you're getting in on, right?
You kind of just alluded just to the next topic. So military and presidential strategies, you know, how impacting those are on money and finance. And specifically talking about Eisenhower's, you know, from battlefield to the balance sheet, kind of how he handled his life and leadership. How would you address that as far as, I mean, I think about the budgeting apps that are out for a person like that, you know, the technology, you know, would he just, you know, keep his spending under military grade control, or would he be adventuresome and kind of tap into some of those resources?
I just can't imagine with that haircut, that discipline, that made bed in the morning, that square meal, you're not getting off of that budget. You're following that disciplined app. You're following that spending. You know that to the penny, that budget, and you're following it. I mean, that to me makes sense from an Eisenhower kind of finance perspective, and that's how the roads got built. That's how a lot of things got done. That's how you did it without a lot of debt. I mean, again, I can't help but carry a lot of analogies there, but to me, that makes a lot of sense as a very disciplined finance strategy without a lot of leverage, without a lot of fancy stuff going on. But you know what? It's a lot of point A to point B without a lot of fancy stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
Spencer,
I agree completely on that one.
And certainly adopted today. You know, behavioral finance never changes. So the same things that were issues among humans back then apply to today. And bottom line is what you said. You know, the discipline is what gets you there ultimately. The rigidity sometimes of doing things automated will get you to success faster.
Yep.
Time-tested growth, Benjamin Franklin's wisdom on investing and the power of compounding. I want to talk about that. So I wonder what he would think about the Roth IRA.
He would love it, yeah.
You think he would?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I love Ben Franklin. Yeah, he's a great one, too. No, I'm sure he would be all on it. These days, again, it's so sophisticated. He'd probably just be in love with high-yield savings accounts. You probably don't have to go into Roth IRAs. He would just love a bank account that pays you 3.5% interest for sitting there and let it do its thing, which is what we should all have as a cash reserve. So that, Roth IRAs, I mean, he'd be in love with it all. It's so sophisticated compared to the 1700s.
Could you imagine telling him he was on the $100 bill and there was a Roth IRA and you could invest in it with compound interest? Could you imagine the party he would throw? I mean, you know he liked to party too, so.
Yeah, especially out in Paris,
I'd like to be there. Yeah, yeah, exactly, Spencer.
He was a risk taker, though.
Yeah,
he was an entrepreneur.
Would you say innovator is synonymous with risk taker?
No, I would say I wouldn't say that. To me, the risk taker goes back to like the railroad conversations and some of those speculative industries that people were putting all their fortunes into or actually going and trying to get involved in a gold mine out west and then put all your money in there. That's a risk taker and that's probably too much risk. And so if that was a universal takeaway for people listening, like that's a whole different level of risk that we don't really talk about on a day-to-day basis. I think Ben Franklin was just a genius and he was someone who knew to take advantage of some practical tools, but I don't think he was a crazy risk taker necessarily.
Not to argue with you, but flying a key on a kite in a windstorm, holding it yourself?
Yeah, that's what I mean. I feel like there was a nonconformist in there somewhere. Wanting to take some risk.
I didn't want
risk.
To divert us too much here. I'm sure you can say that about all the revolutionaries, but.
That's fair. That's a good point.
I read where he left small bequests that grew exponentially over 200 years. I mean, what a legacy.
Yeah. The Library of Philadelphia was one of them. I believe the City of Philadelphia was another.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple of cool ones out there that are really neat. And you look at, again, the power of compound interest and tying it back to finance. Really powerful stuff.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people deal with rising from the ruin, you know, making financial mistakes that can really take you down to square zero. Ulysses S. Grant had debt struggles and is known to have taken himself to a path of financial redemption. So, you know, what do you think he would warn today's clients to vet every investment? I think he would say to avoid it. Avoid can't miss schemes altogether.
Probably if I was Grant and it was at the end of it all for sure. That's pretty much how he lost his money. I think he'd say one thing. You know, save your money and squirrel it away. Don't try and bet it on the farm kind of deal because that's what he did and got punished for it. And he ended up getting his money back writing a book that Mark Twain helped him with. And then he had throat cancer by the end or like mouth cancer, and so he could barely even talk by the end of it. So. Not that that has anything
turned
to do with
hardship
the
into
risk.
Financial legacy
did,
for
yeah.
his family, right?
But he got super speculative, and I think he'd be the first one to admit that he was going in on investments. He probably didn't know what he was talking about, and that's kind of what riddled Grant in political stuff and with his investing side. So yeah, I think he would just say, you know, invest in what you know, and don't do it into things you really don't understand, and let other people run your money for you too much.
Okay, we talk a lot about entrepreneurs on the show. We get into small business conversations. We have quite a few podcasts on those subjects. I want to talk about Madam C.J. Walker's entrepreneurial legacy from washerwoman to wealth builder. I mean, it would be interesting to see what Madam Walker would be doing today. Would she be running an Instagram empire or pitching on Shark Tank? You know, what?
All the above.
You know, that's a very impactful individual. So let's talk about her legacy. How it compares to today's entrepreneurs.
Now, see, I can't really differ too much now. I just see maybe more of the modern era there rather than going back so far. So I could see her hustling today, being able to compete today, being able to run a business today, being able to thrive today. I just don't see too much separation aside from the tools. Mm-hmm. And I could see the adaptation to the tools pretty quickly.
So it's the drive, the mindset.
I think so. And having the right people around. I could see having the right people around that could use the tools. And again, those are the connections that I think will keep some people relevant in any era. Mm-hmm. Some of these people we're listing, I think, could still make it. Ben Franklin, I think, especially, and others too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was that, Spencer?
I said 100%. I agree.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Dynasty to Disaster. This is a fun one to talk about. He's got a really interesting backstory. It's Cornelius Vanderbilt. You know, the blueprint for generational wealth transfer. Would the Commodore be handing out trust fund advice today, do you think, or kind of shaking his head at TikTok as they're kind of just laying out inheritance reveals? Ridiculousness.
First, let's give credit to the greatest nickname on our list here, the Commodore.
I do love that. Yeah.
Man, and you know where that comes from. I mean, sold the shipping empire and went to railroads, which was really cool.
I watched Gilded Age.
Tracy. All right. I didn't know everybody knew that. But the idea of going into the railroads, what a neat thing.
Yeah.
And being able to use some technology and being able to use the legacy and some estate planning along the way, you know, would the Commodore, as you called him, be able to do some of this today? Definitely.
And then talk about his the next generations after him that squandered what he did, you know?
Yeah, I actually had to refresh my memory on that a little bit. What's the saying? It's that the first generation makes it, the second one spends it, third one blows it. Hindsight's 20/20. I feel like for them, like, you almost, at that level of wealth, you would have to put in restrictions in your trust planning so that they never get a huge chunk of the money like your descendants. They just always have to live off a small portion of the income and build their own way, because, you know, I think that's what happened with him, was he left it to a son who passed, and then it split off amongst multiple individuals, and then there was divergent goals on how they want to use the money, and then that's when kind of the extravagance
kicked in. Pretty classic.
Yeah, right, exactly. But again, you would have to have a guardrail. It's not, don't let them get the money until they're 35 and then spend it and blow it. You'd have to say they can never touch a huge portion.
Does anybody do that?
Yep. Compare that to the Rockefeller family that just sold off $1 billion in art and still has a senator. Yeah. Sorry, Spencer. Yeah. Just had to throw that in there.
Senator?
Oh, yeah, you're right. Just passed away. Sorry.
Excuse
Pardon me.
Excuse me.
Pardon.
Am I going to have to separate you two?
Yeah. No, right. I think you'd be huge on it, though. And you know, I was just saying that hindsight's 20/20, and I don't know. It's kind of the same thing. I won't send this down a rabbit hole, but I feel like there's some platitudes you can say with that make people feel good. Like, lock the money away and don't let them get it until 35. And that would have helped the Commodore and his family. Again, at that level of wealth, can never let them touch it.
Because, I mean, I know situations where this is the case, where the first generation, blood, sweat, and tears, building the legacy, right? Spends their whole life building it. Second generation comes in and starts living on it, not working, you know.
Yep.
Just living life in their best life. Third generation is even worse, you know. So they're being taught from the first generation, really. I mean, what was missing? Well, where was the missing? I mean, I'm a parent. Where's the missing component? You teach your kids about money.
Everyone's different, but I mean, it's psychology again. To me, it's, you know, the second you even know the money is there as someone in the next generation, even if you're told you're not getting it anytime soon, if you even know it's there, right? Even if you do your best and you're taught all the right financials and, you know, financial literacy, I would think if you knew it was coming somewhere down the line, you'd still behave a little bit differently.
So you think it's primal?
I think it's psychological. Even with, again, I always tell people this, and everyone's different, and I respect any way people want to go about it, but when it comes, like, even college planning, if you're, in theory, a kid who's 18 who's looking at colleges, if you even think there's a chance that a good bit of it's going to be covered, you probably approach it completely differently than someone who doesn't see it. Multiply that by 100 if you think it's going to be a massive inheritance at your parents or grandparents
passing.
So you think
you can be taught graciousness or grace or appreciation, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be as hard working as your first generation parents.
Well, and again, I tie that back to like Carnegie and Rockefeller and some of those people. I mean, they gave a ton of it away, and I'm sure a lot of that was just out of the kindness of their heart and getting older and just priorities changing. Part of that too is also just not wanting it all to flow down and potentially be squandered, right? Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And they were almost the first to have this kind of wealth to be able to pass it along. Yeah. So you think about they're the first to have this experience. So the first Vanderbilts, I mean, you think about the old school Palm Beaches and Sea Island, their kids were the first ones almost to have that experience of just going to the old school hunting clubs in the winters, just going to summer in Palm Beach. I mean, the real, we don't have to work ever. And then you learn from that, oh yeah, maybe I should have the kids run the business. Maybe I should have them run a full, you know, be in philanthropy or do something on the summer, have some other value. And I think we've all learned that through time, mm-hmm. with family and generational wealth, where, you know what, just having them go to the hunting club or something over the summers, that's, or in the winter, that's not a great idea. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to have some additional value add or some other goals there. Even if you have the money or you have the ability to say, we have enough, you could just lounge all the time. There's no value in that. You've got to do more than just that. And that's hopefully something that's going to protect the family wealth too. Because there's a drive. There's something more than just, hey, let me go
lounge in Palm
Beach.
You're talking about core values.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
About core values.
Because no amount of money is going to keep you from loafing off or perhaps being able to be taken advantage of. You know, you add more zeros to it. Again, like the Vanderbilts or whoever, it can still be lost. It could still be squandered. You can make bad deals. I mean, there's no shortage of that throughout history, just like we went through.
Mm-hmm. Wealth of Wisdom, so Mahatma Gandhi's Ethical Compass and Financial Integrity Today, and we're kind of talking about that as it relates to today's financial planning approach. Do you think he would be proud of or choose a minimalist budget or question why anybody needs 17 subscription services?
Yeah, Gandhi probably would. Yeah.
That's
kind of a dumb question.
We're going a different direction there.
Kind of a dumb question. I mean, his life is kind of a reminder that values-based planning and financial transparency matter deeply. We've been talking about that throughout the show.
Well, I'm going to make my closing monologue and kind of tie all the different topics together, and then I'll let Tony bring us home. But to me, I kind of took the cynical approach when we were going back through this. I was doing a bunch of research. And I was getting to the end. I'm like, the reason all these names stand out is because, for better or for worse, all these people made huge impacts and have massive foresight, and there's a reason that we only know a few of those names in the U.S. at the end of the 1800s and their business acumen, and we forget a lot of others and people who probably lost their shirts doing those deals. So to me, I kind of took away, you know, all these kind of really good and interesting stories, you know, just apply it in your own day-to-day. Again, Ben Franklin with the compound interest, I think he'd be thrilled just with getting 4% on your cash reserve, you know, some of those other speculative deals. I joked about North Korea, but right, have a diversified portfolio, know what you're investing in, don't invest in something you don't understand, and then as you continue to grow and your bucket's bigger, continue to plan forward. What's the end game? How do you want to grow this bucket and give it? Is it all going to go to your family? Is it going to go to charity? And then go from there. So I liked this topic. I thought it was fun. But I would just say, and I'm guilty of this too, don't try and get ahead of your skis looking at all these, trying to find the next big thing so you can be remembered, like, you know, Catherine the Great. Maybe you just take the fundamentals, apply it in your own world, and go from there.
And don't get caught up in just the investment aspect of things. As we've seen in history, and then this is what we do every day, there are so many components to a strong financial plan. If you don't have those in place, you're going to tap into that bucket of money to sustain your lifestyle.
Definitely.
Ultimately.
Definitely. Your greatest assets are your time, your health, your friends, your family. I mean, that's stuff that doesn't show up in your net worth.
Yeah, and on the ethical side, too, I think Warren Buffett even just did this. He recently just announced he's going to be stepping down from Berkshire Hathaway, but I think he put out something, he said something to this effect before, and a million people have said it. Just, you know, in the beginning, going back to ethics and who you surround yourself with, just be more concerned with vetting the people that you're in business with or investing with or relying upon to build your foundation. That's a lot more important, more times than not, than finding the deal that's going to get you 15% return versus 12. It's just, that's probably going to bite you in the long run.
Right. Fantastic. This was a lot of fun, proving that even centuries ago, the smartest leaders knew a thing or two about financial planning, and we ain't so smart sometimes. We think as we think we are. They did a lot of good things. Thanks for joining us today as we explored financial wisdom through the lens of history's greatest leaders. And until next time, keep planning with purpose and legacy in mind.
That's a wrap for today's episode of the Managing to Be Wealthy podcast. We help you make the most of your money without any hidden fees or commissions. Remember, the best investment you can make is in yourself and your financial future. Keep listening for more expert advice and tips. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. To schedule a 1-hour complimentary consultation to discuss your financial concerns, visit our website, managingtobewealthy.com.